Bill Alcoholic.
Bill.
So, first step. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. When you hear people talk about this, they break it down. There's two different statements there, two separate thoughts, two separate comments, concepts. And it's kind of the illusion that at one time our lives were manageable, but then they became unmanageable because of our drinking. And I suppose when I really started thinking about this, I always had trouble with that for some reason. I never could pinpoint it. But here's some quotes. I like quotes. And I think that the powerless thing is kind of the linchpin of the steps and of the spiritual path of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because essentially what we're on here is we're seekers. We're looking for something, and out of necessity, because our lives are hanging in the balance. Scott Peck said one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous is that in a sense of community, what brings people together is tragedy or a threat of some kind. And governments all over the world always try to create an enemy so that they have a reason to exist to protect the people from the enemy. So it has a tendency to draw people together. And he says, Alcoholics Anonymous has done an excellent job of keeping the threat alive. You know, there's always this thing hanging over our head. Well, beyond that, I think that there's a spiritual truth in the whole idea of personal powerlessness that transcends just alcohol. But here's a couple of quotes that I really like that pertain to this. One is from the movie Big Fish. And it says, you get used to it, he said. That's what this place is all about, Edward, getting used to things. It's not what I want, Edward said. Well, that too, he said. You get used to that too. You know? Jay Krishnamurti, very high guy. Freedom is not being free from the net, but freedom is in when the net is not. Freedom from something is not freedom. It's only a reaction, the opposite of bondage. Freedom is when bondage is understood. There is great freedom in the understanding and acceptance of powerlessness, bondage. So we have a tendency, like some people will say, the first step says that we're screwed. I don't see it like that anymore. I think it's just a truth that when I come to accept it, there is freedom in that acceptance. The struggling stops. I stop struggling. And when I stop struggling, I stop suffering. Thomas Merton, I cannot make the universe obey me. I cannot make other people conform to my own whims and fancies. I cannot make even my own body obey me. Several experiences of enlightenment that I've had in my personal life have centered around being sick and not wanting to be, being physically sick. And having to look at that and face it and be in a physical position that I don't care to be in. There's nothing probably more powerless than that, than being stuck in a hospital bed or just ill. I have a bad liver. Shocking in AA.
How'd that happen?
I'm the only one in AA that has a bad liver, you know. I
mean, bad liver.
I had hepatitis C, and I had to go through the interferon treatments twice, and I was as sick as I've ever been, and everything changed for me through that experience. Powerlessness over alcohol. If I can grasp that, and I think we've all come to terms with that at some level, sometimes we take it back. essentially, when somebody goes out after having been sober, they have a problem with the first step. Essentially, they don't believe that they're powerless. They think they can control it. No matter what they say to you, I mean, if you really grasp the concept of powerlessness, that I cannot drink and control it, then you just don't. I mean, you get it. You get it. If you go out again, essentially what you're saying is, no, I'm not that powerless. I've made too big of a deal over something, you know. If I can grasp that a little bit, the whole idea of powerless over alcohol, then I've got my toe in the water. What has happened to me over the years is that concept of powerlessness has enlarged. I don't think I have any power over anything. We talked about this a little bit last night. I think I'm utterly powerless. And in nature, that's just my state. That's just the way that it is. And I think when Krishnamurti is talking about understanding bondage or the concept of bondage, I am part of nature. And in that, I'm essentially limited. You know, I'm a human being. I'm not a friend of mine who is enlightened and talks around the world and stuff and has written some books. I was talking to him one day and I said I was talking to him about this natural state, you know, and that if we're all one, if we're all connected, then I can feel what other people feel. I mean, that would be a sign that I'm getting connected. And I looked at him, I said, is that true? And he goes, no. And I went, shit. I thought I had it. It's the arrogance of the human being, of the human animal, to think that the only thing that has consciousness or awareness are other human beings. You know, that the collective unconscious or the collective consciousness, that you can tap into that, therefore you can kind of travel around and be connected to other people. You know, he says, it isn't just other human beings, Bill, it's everything. We're connected to everything. We are part of nature. We're not above it or below it. And he said, stop and think about this. If the human species was eliminated from the face of the earth, just disappeared, the ecological system would go on as if nothing happened at all. There wouldn't even be a blip, because we barely add anything to the mix. But if the insects were eliminated, the whole thing would collapse. He says, so how important are we in the scheme of things? Really, stop and think about it. You know? That's pretty powerless. I mean, and the way that works for me is that if in the silence, in the quietness, if I can get to that feeling of connectedness around me, then I become part of everything. I'm no longer separate. In my own understanding, in my own knowingness, I'm connected to nature. I'm part of everything. And in that, I have a part to play. And it's a relatively well-defined part. I mean, there's things that I can do and things I can't do. I can't fly, but I can get in an airplane. We can create vehicles to do that. But I'm limited. I can't run as fast as the lion or the tiger. You know, I can't swim as fast. It's amazing to me that when you see human beings, that we idolize athletes, and we are probably the least athletic of all the creatures on the planet. You know, I mean, we are slower than half the animals that exist, probably, you know. We can't swim faster than a dolphin. We don't even come close, you know. And yet we idolize this thing, like somehow we're above it all. And I don't believe that's true. I think we're part of everything. And this whole idea of grasping powerlessness, there is freedom in that. There is the end of suffering. That when I come to realize that I don't need to have any power, that the universe by its very nature is a giving place, that I'm being supplied everything I need all the time. I just take exception to what I'm being supplied with. You know, I look at it and I go, no, no, no. I need more than that. A Lamborghini would be nice. You know? Or whatever it is that I desire. You know, I look at and I have a desire. I look at a goal that I want to achieve. So I place it up here and I keep my eye on the ball. You know, because especially Western people like us, we've been raised to believe that we are the masters of our own destiny. That if I don't do something, it's not going to happen. I got to go out and make it happen. I got to go get it done. Second place is the first loser. You know, don't you love that? You know, every time I see somebody with that t-shirt, I just want to kill them.
And you'd be first.
That's my spiritual response to this thing that I don't agree with. You know, like, shut up. You know, that kind of thing. We got to make it happen. So I established this goal. And anything that doesn't look like that gets rejected. Anything that comes to me that isn't that is incorrect, and I reject it. So I'm very limited in my ability to progress because of that. And it isn't the desire that's the problem. It's the attachment to it that's the problem. When I let go of that, when I let go of the attachment, not necessarily even the desire, but when I let go of the attachment, all of a sudden my horizon enlarges. My experience at my age and my life experience, even in business, tells me that that goal that I set for myself never happens. It's always 10, 20, or 30 degrees off from it. It isn't 180 degrees. You know, it's just off a little bit. It isn't quite the way that I thought it was going to be. You know, it's like when you pray for that mate, you know, please God, send me someone. She never looks the way I think she's going to look. You know, it's never. My wife is not the one that I picked. She laid in wait for me and trapped me. Once again, I'm a victim. You know?
And we're all grateful.
Yeah, thank God for Karen.
Thank God for Karen.
Say that again for the tape.
Yeah. I love you, Karen.
So do we.
We all love you. But those desires that I have can be traps. Those desires are my bondage. And it is not the elimination of the desire that's the key. It's the attachment to it. There's nothing wrong with desire. Nothing wrong with having goals. There's nothing wrong with planning for the future. Just don't pack. You know? Planning is okay. I'm not. When I'm planning in the present moment. I'm not in the future. I'm right here, right now, making a plan. Conscious of the fact that I'm absolutely powerless over the outcome of this plan. I have no idea what the future is going to bring. The past is my recollection of what happened. I love what Sandy Beach says, you know, that there's my story and then there's what really happened. You know, so the past isn't really real. And it's my interpretation of what occurred. And I've been around long enough now to know that when I really find out what really did happen, that it bears little resemblance to what I'd been repeating for so many years about that incident or that person or what occurred. And, you know, I take it all personal, which is my first error. You know, life is not personal. My sponsor told me one time, a long time ago, when I was talking about how people are talking behind my back, he goes, put a mirror on your desk at work and write on the bottom, don't take your life too personally. And when you think that, look in the mirror and read the line. You know, it's like, they're not thinking about you, Bill. You're not that important. You know, it's like, but we take everything personal, don't we? I mean, the pain that we feel in our lives is the fact that random stuff happens and we make the mistake because we think we're the center of the universe that it's happening to us. It's just happening. And we happen to be collateral damage. You know, it's like we're just in the vicinity. But it isn't happening to us. It's just happening. It's just unfolding. So this powerlessness, when I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm beaten down, and in your own story, you probably tell the same story about how you became teachable. You started listening to somebody else maybe for the first time in your life and taking a little direction. You understand at that point innately, without even having any conscious or intellectual knowledge of it, of being powerless and being receptive now. I need help. I can't do this on my own. And we start working these steps. We start off with the idea that I need help. We read the doctor's opinion. We read Bill's story. More about alcoholism. There is a solution. All about the first step and then into the second step. If I can get that first step, if I can just a little bit grab a hold of this idea that in and of myself, I am not capable of living this life. I'm not capable of staying sober. I can't take care of myself. It's that bad. I need help. Would you please help me? That's a powerful place to be in. If you and I, through the ages, if we stay sober for the rest of our lives, if we can maintain that very simple little attitude, we have a really good shot at being really happy in life and not being alone. One of the things that happens with people with time is we fall victim to the idea that somehow we have transcended that. And I'll tell you something. I have not transcended that. And I get taught that on a really regular basis. You know, just this first part of this year, I've been in the hospital twice, having surgery, and I'm laying in that hospital bed thinking, powerless, you know, once again, you know, and I'll tell you something, I'm grateful for the nurses, I'm grateful for the doctors, I'm grateful for you people coming to visit me and being there for me, and at this point in my life, I have no problem at all telling you I need help, you know, that I'm frightened or I'm concerned, you know, will you pray with me, whatever it is, you know, I mean, I've let go of a lot of that. I would imagine I'll reclaim some of it back as I get healthier again. But there's always in the back of my head now, there's this understanding that I don't need to live life on my own. That isn't it nice that I don't have to anymore? I don't have to be the master of my own destiny. I don't have to know what the future brings. I understand clearly that when stuff happens, I label it good and bad, right or wrong, and it really isn't either one. But I know my human nature is to label things. But the truth is that there's no morality in nature. Stuff just happens. The lion eats the lamb every time. And we don't like that. We don't think it's right. So we make up parables that say that one day the lion will lay down with the lamb. Well, I'm convinced that lamb's going to be nervous through eternity. You know, it is the nature of the lion to eat the lamb. And there's no morality in it. The lion isn't thinking to himself, oh, look at that little innocent lamb. Nobody wants me to eat it. I'm going to kill it right in front of a bunch of people and teach them who the boss really is. I don't think the lion's thinking that. And I don't think the lamb is thinking, oh, my God, you know, this isn't right. This shouldn't happen. It's unjust. He just goes, shit! There's no, and there, in my life, too, there's, you know, I judge stuff all the time. It's my nature to judge things, you know. And I just go right, I have a great time judging you and taking your inventory. But at the end of the day, I know it's just all bull, you know. I don't know who you are. I'm looking across at you, and I make these judgments that are based on God knows what it is. I don't know what it is. Prejudice, being prejudging people. And when I step back from that, when I step out of that, and I understand that things are just as they are, they are just as they are, you are just as you are. My job, if you can even call it that, is to accept that, which isn't that difficult once you step over the line into that. But I believe it's an experiential process. It's not an intellectual one. It's not about me understanding these concepts and then changing my behavior. It's having a series of experiences that cause me to realize what's going on. I have to grow up through it and live through the experiences that cause me to understand it. And if I don't shy away from it, if I lean into it and I stay in the inventory process and I stay in the amends process and I'm getting out of myself, these conclusions ultimately come in a knowingness that transcends the intellect. It it's an understanding, just life experience is what really brings it to us, I believe. Thank you very much.
Jay Alcoholic.
Yay.
So, we are heir to this movement, this Alcoholics Anonymous thing, and we come from a group called the Oxford Group, and the Oxford Group was an amazing moment in history that was led by a very strange mystic, a guy by the name of Frank Buchman, and Matthew's going to talk a little bit about Frank later, but Frank believed that all that was necessary for anyone to have an experience with God was for them to make an honest experiment. An honest experiment. And I believe that's what the steps are. They're an experiment. You hear a lot about faith. If I just had enough faith, I'd be able to. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have something far more important. We have experience. And so when I have a new person that I'm working with, you know, when we're looking at step two, what I like to do is I like to call step two stupid God tricks. Very, very simple things that if you try it, we're not asking you to figure anything out here. Just we're going to take a hypothesis and we're going to work with it. And if it works, we're going to go, oh, this is cool. And if it doesn't work, we can throw it away. But you're the only one that can make that determination. Now, the thing that drives many people, aside from drugs and alcohol, into looking for the spiritual path is the other sex. My personal case, when I was about 4 months sober, I was tending bar, and this exotic creature decided she wanted what I had, and we started running around, and I'm newly sober, and she moves her husband out and gives me keys to the vet, and God's will is really a groovy thing, and then after a while, she decided that maybe she had a little problem with drinking. And so I brought her into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, just like helping a sheep over the fence, I wasn't sleeping with a newcomer, you know. We were already involved, and so this is just a natural, you know, natural thing. And so I'd bring her to the meetings, introduce her to all the properly spiritual people and all the right old-timers and where to sit and all the meetings in West Los Angeles and all that stuff. After about 3 months, she left me for another woman and then brought her to the meetings and introduced her to the old-timers. And then I know that maybe here in Louisiana, special rural Louisiana, you guys don't have to sometimes cruise past the meeting to check the cars out to see whether you can go to the meeting or not because she might be there.
Or he.
So anyway, yeah, or he, yeah. So anyway, I'm devastated, and I'm sitting out in front of the Alano Club, waiting for it to open because God had not created, consciousness had not evolved to where there was morning meetings yet. Well, meetings didn't start till noon. You had to wait. So I'm sitting outside of the club waiting for the meeting because I don't know how not to drink under tragic circumstances such as this. And there's Irish Dan. Now, I don't know how you can get sober without being around Irish Dan. And so I tell him my tale of woe, and he looks at me and he goes, so what's your prayer life like, kid? what are you talking about? You know, I didn't say that to him. I never said that to him. What? And he goes, well, look, he said, your problem is not what you think your problem is. And he said, we're gonna. He says, what's your prayer life like? And I said, well, okay, I'm doing the AA stuff. Well, I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous that in order for prayer to be, it should be personal and it should be honest. So every morning when I get up, I get down on my knees and I go, help! Because, you know, I really don't know that I can get through a whole day not drinking. I need help. And then I'll go to an AA meeting during the course of the day, and I'll say the prayer with people, and maybe I'll say the serenity prayer a couple times. And then when I get home at night, before I get in bed, I'll get out on my knees and I'll go, thanks. And those two things are like the way that my prayer life still is. I may hang a lot more syllables on, or I may hang no syllables on it at all. It just may be a feeling that comes to me in the silence. But he said, okay, now what we're going to do is we're gonna double your prayer life. Really? He said, you got a job, kid, right? Yep. He said, and you're an alcoholic male, so you go the same way no matter what. Yeah. He said, now on your drive to work, what I want you to do is I want you to find a spot. And this is going to be your God spot. And when you hit that spot, what I want you to do is say, hi. And when you come home from work, I want you to do the same thing. I want you to say, hi. Well, the great thing about saying hi is that generally something follows it. And what he was doing was he was giving me the opportunity to get outside of the weird ideas that I had about what prayer was or about what the higher power was, about what a relationship with God was like, and to just get in a conversational relationship with the power. This is conscious contact. Hi is conscious contact. And usually, after a time, something would come along behind that. I'd start to think about maybe somebody that was having difficulty in the meeting. I would not be thinking about myself for just a moment. So again, what's happening? More conscious contact. Another wonderful thing I was taught was that the higher power is very humble. It will not go any place that it's not invited. If I want to walk out into my day and do it myself, that's fine. But if I say, hey, come along with me. Now, we all know that one of the most spiritual things you ever learn in Alcoholics Anonymous is get in the car, right? Well, the higher power loves to get in the car. You know, but you got to invite it in. And so in this, what happens is that I start to have a relationship with whatever this power is that's going to restore me to sanity. And you know what is sanity for me? Sanity for me in the beginning is just not pouring booze down my throat. You know, one of the ways I love to terrorize new people. I mean, it's just so much fun. It's, you know, and one of the ways that I love to do it in regards to this thing about having a conscious contact, having this thing about a new relationship with whatever this power is, because we don't have to figure it out, is God, as I understand, God loves to smoke with new guys. You know? If you meet somebody that's new, tell them to write HP on their cigarette pack. And every time that they go burn one, invite the higher power to go have a cigarette with them. A new person who smokes three packs a day is the most spiritual guy in the room. you know? But I mean, you know, it's totally like Native American anyway. But anyway, so it's this thing about how is it that I'm gonna come up with this whole second step thing? I mean, God, as I understood God at the time, was all kinds of nonsense. Some of my friends still think that that's my relationship with the power. But the thing that's important for me is to continue this invitation, to continue to seek. And it's always fluid, it's always reaching out, it's always trying new stuff. And to pay attention of what's going on. So this thing about having the God spot, it's a real practical way to evidence this thing about there being this higher power and me actually having a relationship with it so that I can get over to the decision part. I think that's it.
So step three, a Matthew alcoholic. It's nice sitting with my my closest friends and talking about this because clearly what Bill said bled into step two and step three, and clearly what Jay slid bled into step one and step three. They're just interconnected. And last night, Jay said these are 12 spiritual exercises, and sometimes I look at the steps as 12 surrenders. They're 12 surrenders. The first one, we admitted. The second one, we came to believe something bigger. Third one, we turned our will and our life over to the care of that. And I think sometimes the difficulty when working with newcomers is, what does that mean? What does it mean to turn your will and your life over to the care of something? And it is hard to describe. What is it we're surrendering? So what I wanted to do is talk a little bit about what surrender means and the literature to me, and then give a little of my own experience and some experience of the people I've worked with. And the 12 and 12 says something pretty powerful, you know. It says, step three calls for affirmative action, for it is only by action that we can cut away the self-will, which has always blocked the entry of God or a higher power into our lives. The effectiveness of the entire AA program will rest upon how well and earnestly we have tried to come to a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. And there's a great line in there that says, you know, nothing's going to turn me into a non-entity. You know, if I keep turning my life over, you know, I'll become like the hole in the donut, right? Remember that? Ever read that part of the literature? I'm going to become the hole in the donut. And one of my favorite speakers, actually, I just look at him as like my spiritual guide, and I've never met him, is Sandy Beach in AA. And he says, well, what would it mean to be a hole in a donut? What would that mean? He goes, it would mean you're becoming a completely spiritual being. And the Buddhist would say, yes, become the hole in the donut. That's good. Yeah. My other spiritual teacher that I've never met is J.D. Salinger. The guy who wrote a bunch of books that I really love. And in one of my favorite books, Franny and Zoe, Franny Glass says, I just wish I had the courage to be an absolute nobody. So that's kind of walking along the edge of what I'm trying to say about surrender. So I'm going to give you an example in my own sobriety. When I was newly sober, I think it's worth just telling this an introduction to the story. So my brother met me on my porch, is where we left off last night, and he took me off to a 30-day rehab in the desert. And all I remember from that place is I gained 47 pounds. I know we talked a lot, and there was some, you know, group discussion, and I did some step work, but I was tired and scrambled. And when we got back out, my brother drove me home, and as he pushed me out, you know, I have a month-old baby. My mom's still dying of cancer, and tens of thousands of dollars of debt, and I got to get a job, and I got to go see this baby, and I got a lot to do. My brother says, go to a meeting, as he's pushing me out of the car. Now, remember, I've not been to AA. I've been to a rehab. And I get out of the car going, oh, right, I'm going to go to a meeting. It's like, I got some stuff. You guys with AA, little kind of into the meetings, you know? I got some stuff. I got to get a job. I got to go see. I don't even know what that apartment looks like. I've been gone for a month, and I got to go help see Phoebe and straighten that out and go visit my mom. I was like, wow, go to a meeting. How lame. And I walk up on my porch and I open my door and somebody hands me a beer. Yeah, I joke, it wasn't a beer, it was a Coors. But I back out of there and I put that beer down and I ran away from my own house. And I would love to tell you it's because I had a foundation in recovery, but the truth is all I had in the world was 30 days. That's all I had. I didn't have character, I didn't have self-respect, I didn't have any money, I didn't have any friends. I had nothing. I had less than nothing, but I had 30 days, and I wasn't going to waste it on those losers that had taken over my apartment. And I ran to a payphone. Some of you are kind of young. They were glass rectangular things that had doors like this. You might still see them in the French Quarter. I don't know if they do. But I went in there, and I called AA. And I'm a brilliant kid with 2 degrees, and I couldn't find AA in the phone book because I thought it must be so embarrassing they'd put it in the back. I didn't realize it would be in the front. And so it took a while, and then I called AA, and I yelled into the phone my entire story so far. I was a rock star, and then I had 108 pounds, I had a baby, my mom's got cancer. And the poor guy, because I thought he needed information in order to help me. Right? And this guy listens, and then when I finally give him a half a second to say something, he goes, hey man, where are you? And I looked out, these things were made of glass, and I looked out through the payphone, and I read off the street sign. And he said, he's slipping through some paper. I can hear him on the phone. He goes, man, this is so weird. I said, what's that? And he said, there's a meeting right across the street from the corner you're on. And it starts in like 15 minutes. And I said, what do you think I should do? Because I had not taken step 3 yet. And he said, he was dumbfounded. He goes, I think you should go to the meeting. And so I went into the meeting and I was terrified. It was a big speaker meeting, like 500 people. It's called Stompers. It's not there anymore, but I was really afraid, you know, because everybody's looking at me and talking about me and thinking about me, all 500 of them. And that's my newcomer brain that I brought in there. And I went over, and I don't know if anybody can relate to this, but remember when you went to your first meeting, it was very crowded, and it seemed like there was one chair, and it was right in the middle, and there was a spotlight on it? That's how I felt. I'm sure that's not the truth. That's the story as I remember it. It's not what really happened. But I went up and sat in this chair, and I sat down, and I had a moment of peace. I felt like I might be okay. And there was no rationale for that. I didn't know you. I was afraid of you. I didn't know what was going to happen to me in there. I didn't have a house anymore to go back to, but I had a feeling that it was going to be okay. And for me, that was kind of step 2. Because it wasn't going to be me doing it. I didn't have a plan. I had a feeling that it was going to be okay. So leading into step 3 for me, to give you a concrete thing, and then I want to talk a lot about surrender. Well, no, let's talk about surrender first. So if you're the hole in the donut, right, it says in literature, we abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Well, does anybody ever really think about the radical implications of that, to abandon yourself to God? I mean, do we ever touch on that? You know, one of my big heroes is Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi is a Indian. Yeah, he's a diminutive guy. But he has had a big effect on my life. And he talks about surrender like if you get on a bus with your bags, your suitcases, you don't stand there holding your suitcases. You put them on the bus, and the bus carries them. And he said, oftentimes surrender is mistaken for standing on the bus holding our suitcase. Well, I'm sort of surrendering. And one of the quotes I love that he says, well, first we've got to start with a Brooksism. We have a guy named Brooks in our group that says wonderful things. Bill just reminded me of a Brooksism. And Brooks says, we label things good and bad, right? And Brooks says, you know, once I stopped labeling things good and bad, really good things started to happen. So he says stuff like that. And one of the things he says is, I'm completely willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as long as it gets me what I want. And that's, again, kind of the idea that we're not doing it. And so this Ramana Maharshi quote that I love is, surrender to him and abide by his will wherever he appears or vanishes. Await his pleasure. If you ask him to do as you please, it is not surrender, but command to him. You cannot have him obey you and yet think you have surrendered. He knows what is best and when and how to do it. Leave everything entirely to him. His is the burden. You no longer have any cares. All your cares are his. Such is surrender. So this is all wonderful talk. But when you're new, or when you're not new, step three seems baffling. So I'll give you some examples. One pretty big example in my life was after I got sort of on my feet in sobriety, I was living with my parents, and it was very embarrassing. I was 30 years old and had this baby across town. And I had this job delivering packages in the morning, and I had a job from midnight to 4 in the morning stacking newspapers on a loading dock. And I would just say the serenity prayer and smoke cigarettes and do my job because I was so afraid to think a thought or go outside the boundaries. I just didn't want to drink anymore, and I was very afraid that I was going to drink again. But I was also in huge debt, and I had a baby, and I didn't want to live with my parents. And I made just about enough money to put gas in my car and pay child support and put a dollar in the basket. I didn't make work in two jobs. So I get an interview with the job. I was working with my brother a little bit in the mornings, and he was sober a long time, like I said. And I'm going to meetings at night. I got six meetings a night. I have a home group. I know a lot of people. I'm really trying to do everything I can to change. And my brother says, hey, these people are looking for a manager for their company, for their delivery company. And, you know, you have college and some experience managing that restaurant. And I wasn't going to use them as a reference, but so he sends me over there, and I interview, and I knocked it out of the park. And the guy said, hey, so that's great. And I go, what are the hours? And he goes, it's, well, 7 p.m. to about 4 in the morning. You're the night manager. I said, awesome. And I said, how much am I going to make? And he said, $40,000. And I about fell over. You know, I was making like 12, you know. So, and I thought, wow. And I thought, this is God's will. This AA stuff really, really works, right? And I skipped out to my car, and I drove over to my brother's company because it was in the same neighborhood. All these places are the same. And he goes, well, how'd it go? And I go, he offered me the job. And he said, oh, my God, that's fantastic. He said, when is it? And I go, it starts in a couple weeks. It's from 7 to 4 in the morning. And he goes, oh, man, you can't take that job. I go, why not? And he said, don't you go to meetings at night? Because you're working now during the day, and you got that. Because all your meetings are at night, right? All your fellowship, all the people you know in AA. I said, yeah, but there are meetings during the day. I know. I can go to other meetings. And he said, man, you're only like 90 days sober, dude. He goes, you don't want to do that. And I go, $40,000. He said, I can make $40,000. And he said, yeah. I can't in good conscience tell you to take that job. And I was like, well, who the hell are you to tell me to take the job? So I drove home and I thought, he's kind of crazy, you know, this guy, my brother. And I went to the meeting, and I saw my sponsor at the meeting that night, and I go, it's awesome news. God's will is happening in my life. It's unfolding in my life. And he says, what's that? And I said, I got this job. I said, but my brother said this kind of crazy thing. He said, I shouldn't take it because it's from 7 to 4 in the morning. He said, 7 to 4 in the morning. He said, yeah. And he goes, what are the days? I said, Monday through Friday. He goes, you can't take that job. And I said, what do you mean? I can't take that. Is there a conspiracy of craziness in this place? $40,000. I have a baby. I owe tens of thousands of dollars. This is the answer. This is all my hard work for the last 90 days is paying off. And he said, you can do whatever you want, but I advise you not to take that job. And I didn't take it because I was afraid. I don't want to drink anymore. These guys seem to know. That's step three. Something bigger than me. My will wants to do that, right? I didn't know I was doing step three. Actually, my sponsor talked about step three a little, but I didn't know that. I just went, I was afraid to step off that path. Okay, so I turned my will and my life very practically over. And, you know, just the epilogue of that story, I was later on my brother's loading dock. I came by to see him, and the guy who offered me the job came up and asked me if we were hiring. That company had gone bankrupt like 2 months later. But that, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. The point was, is this thing, what do you surrender when you surrender step three? When someone is new and we always say, turn it over, turn it over, turn it over. That's like saying, bleh, 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 bleh. they don't even know what you mean. You know, turn it over. It's like, you know, and they, so what does that mean? You know, what we're saying to turn over, well, what I've learned over years turning over is my limited perspective. I'm surrendering my limited perspective that if I don't do A and B, then C won't happen. And like Bill really, that's what I was really listening when Bill said, you know, I have this desire, but it never is that. It never ends up being that. But I think I know the path that has to occur for me to get what I need, and I have to surrender that perspective. To what? To this thing that miraculously is keeping me from drinking every day. You know, what's the most profound spiritual experience I've had in AA? I haven't had a drink in 18 years. I've had some mountaintop experiences. I've had some subtle vibrational experiences. But the biggest yellow sign in my face that there is a power greater than me is I don't drink anymore. So we surrender our limited perspective. I'm going to give you two more examples, and I'm going to shut up. One is my friend Iden. I sponsor a guy. I get to sponsor some of the cool, crazy guys. And Bill was actually mad when Iden asked me to sponsor because he wanted it. He's got a pompadour, and he's just a trip. And he's a very capable guy and a hardworking guy. Loves his kids. He's married to this feisty girl, and he loves his little kids. He's just, I've never seen a more connected father. And I'd love to say I was more connected, but I'm not. He is. And he comes to my house a lot, and he was saying, hey, I'm really, really enacting step three in my life. I really feel strongly about how step three is going. And because of the difficulty of trying to convey step three, I said, tell me about that. What does that mean? Well, his wife's name is Terry, and he said, every morning on the weekend when I wake up, I just do whatever Terry wants to do. Step three, I turn my will and my life over to something else. She's loves me. I love her. I don't have to get, he has a house. He could get a lot of stuff done. He has a kid. He works all day on Monday through Friday. He's got a lot of plans, I'm sure. And he just surrenders. He just surrenders. I'm going to do what the woman I love needs me to do this weekend. And he said, you know, life's pretty damn good. So there's these practical things, but I want to finish.
That's a frightening concept.
Worse if you know Terry, but it works really well for him. And I like that because we need to see what does it actually mean? What does it actually mean? So there's one more example. It's hard to get to this story, but I married somebody who I loved tremendously. Met her at a bus stop. Fell in love with her. We were engaged in 3 weeks. We've been married for 15 years. We have a couple of kids together. And when we were married for 5 years, she had a stroke. A really pretty nasty stroke. It took out the whole left side of her body and a big handball size of her brain, chunk of her brain. And when it had just happened, about 6 or 7 months into caring for her and our two children, and I had a new job, and I'm trying to stay active in AA, and I'm trying to act like everything's cool and I'm on top of it. You know, I actually fell asleep vacuuming one time because it was just too much. You know, she's paralyzed and brain damaged, and so I'm always worried, you know. I get in my head in the car and I'm driving down the freeway and I'm thinking, you know, I'm a shitty husband, you know. I think everybody thinks I'm this great guy, but I have lots of resentment and I'm not good at this. And, you know, if Philippa really knew me, she'd wake up screaming and get out of the house. And she's way out of my league and I'm an idiot and just all. And you know what? And I'm a crappy father too while I'm at it. You know, these kids, I come home and I want to be, you know, Robert Young. And I'm like, God damn, why are your toys on the floor? I got to pick that up. You know, mom's going to fall. Mom can't walk. You know, and I'm preoccupied all the time. Every time I come out of blackouts of thinking and my children are talking to me and I realize I'm not listening, you know. And I know that that's the key to nurturing their inner selves is just listen. And I'm not doing it. And I'm driving on the freeway, so I'm a bad dad. I'm a bad husband.
And I'm going, oh, Christ, this job, if they only knew what a flake I was, I'm going to get fired, you know, because I'm talking to scientists. I'm a stoner English major, you know, and I'm talking to scientists, and I half the time I can't believe they're listening, and I don't do all the paperwork right, and man, I'm a lame, you know, I got to go. And I call Bill because I'm having a nervous breakdown on the 710 freeway. And I call Bill, and Bill's not home, which always I take personally. You know, this guy, oh, right, don't answer. And he answers 99% of the time. You know, so I am really a little princess when it comes to being a sponsee. It's like, Bill, you did not answer. And so I'm shaking with fear. I'm now decided I am not up to any of the aspects of my life. I'm a fake. So I call Jay, because that's his sponsor. And I go, bleh, you know, I'm a terrible father. I'm a terrible husband. And these kids, they're going to be screwed up for life. I'm going to pay for therapy. And I can't go to job. My job sucks. I'm a terrible man. And I got. And he's just listening to all this. And he says, he goes, okay. You okay? I said, okay. And he said, let's pretend for just a minute that you're not in charge. And I just started laughing. Remember? I just burst out laughing and my shoulders relaxed. You know, my will and my life were suddenly back in my care, and I was giving myself a grade. My will and my life were God's, are God's, and God's in charge. God knows who Philippa needs as a husband. God knows who Rory and Sophie need as a father. God knows who Amgen needs as their director of training. And that happens to be me today. I don't know what it's going to be tomorrow. But he said, what are you doing right now? I said, I'm driving on the 710 freeway. He said, then just drive on the 710 freeway. That's your job. And it was all gone. That's the nature of the third step. So I just want to finally close with something I learned. I just did a fifth step with somebody, and they said something to me that I think is the crux. There's always a little place where, well, where am I not turning my will and my life over? How can I look at this? How can I see what's happening with my will, with my third step? And I think the biggest fear, or a fundamental fear that is all-encompassing and touches all of our lives and has changed the course of our lives, I know for me, and I know for people I work with, and I know for people in my family, is the fear of telling the truth. The fear of telling the truth. Do I want to tell my boss how that really went? Do I want to tell my wife that she called? Do I want to tell my children X, Y, Z? Is it safe to tell the truth? When I get to my fourth step, do I really want to tell that? That's that little door in us. We're either going to tell the truth or we're not going to work the third step. We're either going to turn our will and my life over to the care of God and trust that the truth, which is God's story, the truth is God's version of events. The lie is how I want you to think it went. So if I tell the truth, if I take that little turn and trust God just a little bit, you know, what will happen? And my experience is I will be lifted, I will be enhanced, my limited perspective will break open every single time. A lie has not served me. And when we become honest, think of the fourth step as a demonstration of the third step. I think that's all I have to say.
A couple of quotes. Bernard Bailey. When they discover the center of the universe, a lot of people will be disappointed to discover they are not it.
Wow.
Einstein quote. Always good. When you look at yourself from a universal standpoint, something inside always reminds or informs you that there are bigger and better things to worry about. Mitch Hedberg, I'm sick of following my dreams. I'm just going to ask them where they're going and hook up with them later. It says here, to Bill. Thank you. Just because things are as they are, does that mean that's how they should be? Absolutely. How could they be any different? I mean, the suffering comes from me somehow thinking that reality is incorrect. Isn't this is the source of all suffering right here in this note? Is that I look at something and I make the determination that it should not be. So now I've decided it shouldn't be. Has it changed? I suffer. The problem lies in me thinking it should not be, because it cannot possibly be any different than it is. It's impossible for it to be any different. It's already happened. There it is. And I've determined that it should not be. Therein lies all of my suffering.
All right. We got a lot of questions, which we love.
Yes. By the way.
So I'm just going to take this one. Jake, we'll just pick them as we go. This one is, what do you do with somebody who asks for help but has already made up their mind about what they will or will not do?
Okay.
It is a really good question. And I'll give my experiences. I had to
kill him.
I had a really extremely satisfying experience with the steps, right? Like, my sponsor was very bare bone. It wasn't Bill back then. It was very, read the book, do the step as it comes up, give me his experience. And I had this great, satisfying experience with the steps. And really, I had a pretty profound rebirth as a result. So I had the delusion that I was willing and teachable at all times. I really thought, I went to my sponsor, asked for help, and I was like Grasshopper, you know. I was there, and what should I do? And take the stone from my hand, and, you know. And then I found my old big book, and in the cover of my big book, this church we used to have our meetings in, there was a stack of those stickers that said, hello, my name is, and then you're supposed to write your name for whatever convention, right? And he had taken one of those and stuck it in my big book and wrote, hello, my name is Matthew, and I'm a little stubborn. And I did not like that factual artifact that proved to me that I wasn't teachable and willing. And whoever wrote this, ask yourself, how were you when you got here? And what changed you? I know what changed me wasn't people going, you should, and you should, and you should, and you should, and I know, and you should, and I know. That has never, ever had any effect on me, then I don't want to talk to that person anymore. But what has had an effect on me is, this is what I did. I'm going to go do it. You want to come? People in AA, unlike the church that I grew up in, showed me Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't tell me. It is absolutely natural for someone coming into this situation, leaving their medicine behind, to have decided what they will or will not do. It's the natural state. The surrender was they came. The surrender is they walked through the door. That's a big step. If they walk through this door with some prejudices, let's not throw them away. I think that how do you deal with that? Is you love them. You know, there was a guy used to come into our meeting called Pockets Bob. Big homeless guy, and he smelled so bad. Like, if you sat next to him, he was, you know, that homeless urine smell that caked on him. He just didn't change his clothes. And he came to a lot of meetings. And when I was new and he would come in, I was always happy to see him because he looked like I felt. He smelled like I looked inside. And no one ever threw him out. Someone always had to sit next to him. And I was always, sometimes it was me. I wasn't glad that I got to sit next to him, but I was like, he's okay here, so I'm okay here. This deciding what you will or will not do is fear. And the only way to peel that fear away is to love them through it. They, you know, it's kind of like watching somebody, there's some National Lampoon movie where John Candy's holding on to a ski rope, right? And he's bouncing on the water, right? Bam, bam, bam. And in the boat, they're going, let go of the rope! Yeah. And that's what we're trying to say, is let go of the rope.
Drop
the rock. So the teacher is the fear of drinking again and the pain of living without a solution. That will loosen these things up. That's my experience. But patience and tolerance and demonstration and inviting them along is my experience of how you melt that away.
We got a lot of stuff here. It's a quarter till. We got lunch at noon.
I'll take one more.
Well, let's take a break.
Let me
come back.
Let me do one.
Now, this is a good one.
Yeah. Let me do one, and then we'll go.
That could be a half an hour.
Look, he's talking.
I get 11 minutes on my step. I don't want anything from you guys.
These girls are always like this. I apologize to the women.
Yeah. We're gonna do this. No, we'll just wait. Go along. All the Dharma. Does physical pain hinder spiritual growth? I am married to probably the most spiritual person I know. And I like to say that my wife is like an Italian car. When you get her out on the road, there's nothing better in the world, but she spends a lot of time in the shop. She's had 18 major surgeries. Major surgery is defined when a power tool is produced. She's had strokes. She's had open heart surgery. She's had brain surgery. She's had just all kinds of. And a few years ago, she was diagnosed with a problem where the connective tissue in her body was degenerating. So what had happened is that like she'd just pop out. Like, go and hold her real close and her hip would pop out.
It's her.
And what has happened over the years is that the response has always been in spirit. She has had to do more spiritual work than anyone that I know. And she has done things that are absolutely incomprehensible. 5 months ago, she decided to go off all the medication that she was on. And because life as she was living it was absolutely intolerable. And it was masking the suffering, but it was just barely masking the suffering. And doctors told her, you know, basically all we can do is barely keep you comfortable. And she went through about 12 weeks where she was, I've never seen anybody suffer like that ever. And then finally she came through it. And her relationship with her body and with the pain itself shifted. And it was absolutely miraculous what happened. And does that mean she's not in pain anymore? No. Does that mean she doesn't suffer anymore? No. But her relationship with it has changed, and she's not medicated all the time. And she's actually in a better state of being at most moments than she's been in a very, very long time. So no, physical pain does not, at least in her experience, as I've observed, it does not. My relationship, it's nothing. You know, it's like you talk. The things that I've had happen have been nothing compared to the things that have happened to her. But anyway, no, I don't find that to be a hindrance at all. In fact, each of us has our own particular part of the spiritual gymnasium that we get to work out in. Some of us, it's relationship. Some of it's with money. Some of it's our physical. We've all got our own thing. And why that is, who knows? It's the Leela. It's the dance. And so anyway, that's...
One of the things that Eckhart Tolle says is that it really
resonated with me when I was going through some stuff is that he calls it the pain body. And essentially what happens is that I'm in pain or I'm sick and I become that. That's my identity, is Bill the sick guy. And it's not true. It's, you know, I am more than just Bill the sick guy. Yes, I'm sick, but that isn't all that I am. But I fall victim to that. It's what the ego does, is the egoic mind, is I'll walk outside and I stub my toe. And it hurts. And you get down on the ground, you hold your toe, and tears come to your eyes, and it hurts. I have a stubbed toe. Then this starts. Because the ego does not create anything. It just takes credit for stuff. You know? And it takes that stubbed toe, and it blows it up. And it says, well, if you weren't so fat, you wouldn't have fallen down like that. You've always been clumsy. You've never been an athlete, you know. You tried playing football and you couldn't cut it because you didn't like contact. You're a wimp, you know. And it's just like, geez, I just stubbed my toe. You know? And I think that's where the conundrum comes in. That's where, when we get sick, my tendency is, you know, you stop prayer and meditation and stuff. You just sit around and go, oh. And you get depressed. You don't even know it. People say, you're depressed. You go, fuck you. I am not. You get defensive and stuff, you know, and you become the illness. And it can drive you to spiritual exercise to overcome that. I mean, you can grasp that and see it. And I've had that experience where I was ill. And I went inside out of necessity, just you get reduced to it. And I became other than Bill the sick guy. That did not mean that the illness went away. It just, my consciousness took a shift and decided I'm not going to latch onto this and have it become everything in my life.
Thank you.
So,
should we take a break?
When should we come back?